traffic. Our first case is the outboard marine case. Mr. Geolog.
Please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Alan Gillot, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant Bank of America in the outboard marine matter. This case involves a dispute among creditors over $13.5 million in an unfunded executive benefit program established by the executives of Outboard Marine Corporation, what's commonly referred to as a rabbi trust. At issue is the effort by the trustee to elevate unsecured creditors who are not parties to the trust agreement to establish their priority over an interest in general intangibles that was clearly granted by OMC to Bank of America in a significant credit agreement.
Aren't you conflating two issues, though? Because the first question the bankruptcy judge and then Judge Ashton considered is whether this money belonged in the bankruptcy estate. I take it you don't even want it paid over to the estate. And then the second question, which the bankruptcy judge hasn't ruled on yet, is how it's going to get allocated once it's in the estate.
No, Your Honor, we actually believe it is part. Once OMC became insolvent, the trust corpus reverted to OMC and its bankruptcy estate. So
well, that's your theory, right?
We believe that it clearly is part of the estate, and it needs to be dealt with under bankruptcy principles in the estate.
But you also, well, I mean, there's the fact that the lien issue has been ruled on. I know, but your theory is that this paused somehow at OMC, contrary to the terms of the trust agreement, which said if there was an insolvency, the trustee was supposed to just find out from the bankruptcy court what to do with it.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe under bankruptcy law that upon insolvency, the trust sort of collapses in a sense, and the money reverts to OMC and its estate, bankruptcy estate. And so from that perspective, it is in the bankruptcy estate and needs to be dealt with by the bankruptcy court as part of the estate. We believe trustee's position seeks to sort of establish a separate, outside the bankruptcy code, matter to be dealt with by the trustee and by the trustee of this rabbi trust. Such that it would
really
be handled separately.
A serious problem with the language of the trust agreement. It says, you know, shall not create a security interest in favor of any creditor.
Yes, Your Honor, and we believe that. Well, we believe that that is, as we state in our papers, under Illinois law, the UCC, and general principles, that restricts the right, but not the power, of OMC to grant a security interest.
That's a distinction I don't understand at all.
Well, that, Your Honor, that's in the Lomas decision.
Well, does it make a sense of some sort, or just some legal irrationality?
No, Your Honor, we believe it's one of the cornerstones of the sort of the modern credit economy. The restrictions on alienation.
I don't understand you. How would the credit economy be damaged by reading any creditor just mean any creditor?
Well, Your Honor, it's because the ability to alienate property is something that has been one of the developments.
Yes,
that has taken
I know,
place.
But be concrete. How is the economy going to be hurt by this?
Well, in this case, for example, I mean, to take this case.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Right. In this example, in 1998, a significant credit arrangement was performed between OMC and the Bank of America and the participating banks in that transaction. And one of the security interests that.
Look, Bank of America, when you made that loan, you knew about this trust agreement. You could read the trust agreement. You could see that you couldn't create a security and obtain a security interest in the rabbi trust.
Well, Your Honor,
how is the credit economy damaged by the fact that you couldn't obtain a security interest?
Well, if we could back up as to what the purpose of this provision is in section 4.03.
Yeah, but can't we back up to Judge Posner's question? The thrust of your argument seems to be that security interests always and inevitably must cover every last scrap of property that somebody has, that somebody can grant a security interest in less than all of it, and given the language of this trust agreement, it appears that OMC granted a general intangible security interest in less than all of what it had.
Well, Your Honor, again, just to sort of back up on what the purpose of 403 is. The purpose of 403, at the end of the day, is to prevent the executives of OMC, who are one of the participants in the Rabbi Trust, from seeking to circumvent the Rabbi Trust requirements that the Rabbi Trust at all times remain the property of OMC until such time as the
payment
is
made. Why does it use any creditor then?
Well, it uses any creditor because it says executives, participants, or creditors because of the ways in which executives could establish credit arrangements.
You think it means creditors of executives?
It means creditors or individuals that could establish security interests that could redound to the benefit of the Rabbi
Trust.
How could
that be unless they were the executive's creditors?
Because the creditors could take steps to establish and enter into transactions where creditors were coming to existence and credit security interests are given in those credit situations.
I don't follow you.
Well, to make sure that the money doesn't move around, the money has to stay at all times, the trust corpus has to stay at all times subject to the general creditors of the estate.
But that's just the tax law, and it seems to me here you do have a trust agreement. The parties could put, subject to what they needed to do to get the tax consequences they wanted, whatever they wanted, and 4.03, you're jumping beyond the language to intent, but don't we need to start with the language and perhaps finish there? The company shall not create a security interest in the trust corpus, and then there are three different beneficiaries it can't have, the beneficiaries of the Rabbi Trust, the participants, or any creditor.
Well, Your Honor,
the company is the one that can't create the security interests, and you're not arguing that Bank of America, that this was concealed from them or anything, were you?
No, Your Honor, we're not suggesting that this was concealed from us. Okay. But what we are suggesting is that it's the right, and under Section 4.03, so long as the power of the OMC is not limited in establishing a security interest. Under these principles of law, the brief statement, the laws in Illinois, which we cited in our brief, Lomas, and the series of cases that relate to that, the UCC provision, that's 9.3.1.318.4.
Yeah, I think that applied.
Well, Your Honor, we acknowledge that whether or not Northern is an account debtor is an issue. We've argued that it is in our papers. We acknowledge that that may not be literally fit within the definition of an account debtor. But the principle does apply. The principle of the UCC provision, again, puts very strict limits on the restrictions on alienability, as does the case law in Illinois. And in the absence of the power, a limitation on the power of OMC to establish this security interest, we believe what happens here is that they do have the ability to do so. Nothing is rendered void or invalid in the trust agreement, but what happens is the assignment is valid. If someone wants to sue OMC, one of the parties to the trust agreement wants to sue OMC for breaching the obligation in 4.03 not to establish.
And why is that preferable to I don't understand. I can understand situation with restraints on alienation or problem, but I don't see it here. You're seeking a windfall because when you read this, you knew that when you first made the loan, you would have known, your lawyers would have said that you probably wouldn't be able to reach any money in this fund.
Well, Your Honor, again, we believe the law, again, establishes, even though the words say that you cannot establish a security interest, there's no limitation on OMC's ability to do so. There's no limitation on their power. There's nothing that says this thing is void. It cannot be done.
But was that the analysis when you made the loan? Analysis of the trust agreement?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what the analysis of the trust agreement
was. Well, I think that goes to Judge Posner's question. I mean, you saw what the language was. You made the loan without a...
The loan was clearly made, Your Honor. Yes, I agree.
With no hope of anything but a tiny reversionary interest of whatever was left over after the beneficiaries were paid. You didn't think you were going to get that money unless they went bankrupt, in which case the trust agreement also addresses what happens in the event of bankruptcy. But the other thing that's troublesome is you're reading Illinois as absolutely forbidding anti-assignment clauses, and I thought that there were Illinois cases, some of which are cited in your opponent's brief, that say that although Illinois courts don't like these, it's a question of the intent of the parties, and if you read 4.03, the intent of the parties certainly seems pretty clear.
Well, Your Honor, the trustee relies on principally four cases, which all relate to the structured settlements.
Right.
And,
okay. So what's
and
wrong with that in terms of stating a general principle?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the structured settlement cases. They rely, though, on two specific enactments of the Illinois legislature that specifically state that before an insurance company can pay a structured settlement amount, to anyone other than the beneficiary, it has to go to court to get approval.
Sure, but you could make the same argument here that this rabbi trust, you know, if you go to the ruling of the tax of the IRS and to their model, you know, rabbi trust, they use this term general creditors, which is usually assumed to be a synonym for unsecured creditors. So if the company doesn't make it, you know, doesn't say something like available to satisfy the claims of the company's general creditors, it may lose its tax.
Well, Your Honor, we would say that on that, we don't believe that general creditors can be read to be unsecured creditors. There's
well,
nothing.
They certainly can be. I don't know why you say that.
Well,
look, if you were a tax lawyer, you'd say, here's this tax ruling which says that the trust assets must be available to general creditors. General creditors usually, often, generally, sometimes means unsecured creditors. If we start creating security interests, instead of reserving the money for the general creditors, the IRS may deny our benefit. Now, wouldn't that be simple, you know, tax counseling prudence to say, make sure you don't create a security interest in this trust?
Well, Your Honor, I would... First of all, I don't believe that the IRS regulations are quite as specific as...
They are quite as specific. They use the term general creditor.
Well, just to take an example, there are other trust agreements that just use the term creditor. I mean, for example, if you look in the case, one of the cases we cited was McAllister v. RTC in our brief, and that contains the listing of what the provision that states what the limitation is, and that
sure,
provision
but it certainly
talks about creditor.
Would, say, it would be prudent tax counseling to say, because the IRS, for mysterious reasons, uses the term general creditors, don't create a security interest in your rabbi trust fund.
Well, Your Honor, again, I think the provisions both of the IRS, the tax bulletins, and the case law out there does not, you know, naturally leads to the conclusion that general creditors always have to be unsecured creditors. Turning to the point on the section 4.03, I mean, just if we discuss that briefly, I mean, again, the case law in Illinois, the Lomas decision, the Ginsburg decision, Village of Westlake, and a variety of the cases that in Illinois do stand for the proposition that so long as you don't prohibit the ability of the party to make an assignment, that assignment is valid, even though it may violate the provisions of the agreement. And on that basis, we believe that it is appropriate for OMC to be viewed as having granted a security interest in whatever rights it had in the Rabbi Trust, which again will not come into being, perhaps, until bankruptcy.
Well, there the trustee argues at the most it initially had reversionary rights, and then upon the event of insolvency it had zero rights because the rights were all within the power of the trustee in the bankruptcy court. In other words, perhaps it had legal ownership at all time, but it had no rights of disposal ever.
Well, Your Honor, that is inconsistent with what the rabbi, again, the purpose and the function of the rabbi trust, whereas the entity that establishes the trust, in this case OMC, has to be the legal owner.
Of course it's the legal owner, but I'm talking about rights to dispose of. The reason you create rabbi trusts is to segregate the funds so that they'll be available for these participants. So the company had this segregated fund, and so what it might have been able to encumber was only the reversionary interest, and then zero.
Well, but on bankruptcy, again, because the legal owner is the OMC, the money goes back to OMC under bankruptcy principles. That's where, as the legal owner, it has to come back and come back into the estate. And on that basis, it's available to the estate under bankruptcy law, and the trust agreement cannot...
Well, only if it was ever encumbered, though. I mean, you know, we're sort of talking in circles. I know you've made this argument in your brief, so it's, you know, I'm aware that it's there.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Jalal.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Good morning. My name is Steve Tobin. I'm here on behalf of Alex Molia, who is the trustee of the Chapter 7 estate of Outboard Marine, together with my partner, Ms. Klaus. And I think I'd like to be able to address Judge Wood's first question about property of the estate. And I think Judge Aspin dealt with that issue in the court below, kind of using traditional notions of trust property and understanding the confusion between the different ownerships. There's shorthand for that in the bankruptcy code. It's 541D. 541D basically says that a debtor may have legal ownership of property but have no equitable interest. And, of course, the only interest that OMC had upon its insolvency was legal title to that property. So that's what 541D says. It does say it is property of the estate, and that's where the court gets jurisdiction. It also has core jurisdiction because it's going to affect, obviously, how much money the unsecured creditors get. So I think that's where the issue, and I think the issue is muddied up on the jurisdictional issue as to whether or not this was property of the estate and what type of property. And I think that the argument that the bank is making really ignores the fact that the bank's interest in this could only be limited to what OMC's interest was. Which,
what was the purpose for setting up the trust?
The purpose was to protect the executives on a buyout, which occurred in 1997 by Mr. Soros. And the reason that they didn't want a lien granted on that property is because if they did that, it would jeopardize the executive's interest in that money. The company could remain solvent, get default on a credit agreement with Bank of America. Bank of America can then foreclose on its credit lien, on its lien, its security interest, take the money away from the executives, which was not the intent whatsoever. So that's why 403 was there. And to protect also, I should say, as Your Honor's pointed out, the tax benefits for the executives, because if the executives could get the lien, then they would basically have too much of an interest in the money that was the corpus of the trust, and therefore they would lose the tax benefits. And I think that's why
it is puzzling, and why the purpose of the rabbi trust, why is the purpose of the rabbi trust subverted if the company pledges the assets to a particular creditor rather than to all the creditors?
Because you can default on that credit agreement. And if you default on that credit agreement, the secured creditor then forecloses on the money that's dedicated to the executives. That was the whole point of this trust. That's what their negotiation was.
That was your previous point, but I mean from the tax, from the IRS, if you go back to its ruling, why did the IRS, general credit doesn't appear in its ruling, all it does about general assets and creditors and so on, but why from the IRS standpoint, what's important is that the company's creditors have the right to the property in insolvency. That's the key. But why does it have to be the general creditors rather than some specific creditors, secured creditors?
I'm not sure that it does. I don't know that there's any ruling that says it has to be, but in this situation,
so you're really relying on the language
done.
Of the trust agreement.
Absolutely.
Rather than on the tax law.
4.01 and 4.03 of the trust agreement make it absolutely clear that once that trust is funded, only two things can happen to the money. Solvency, the executives get it. Insolvency, the general unsecured creditors get it. There's another point that I want to make about property of the estate, and there are at least two instances that I know of as a bankruptcy lawyer where a debtor may have no legal or equitable interest in property pre-petition, yet it can administer the property post-petition, becomes property of the estate. The first is Your Honor's decision in Coke Refining, of course, which is the alter ego claim. And there's a situation where only the unsecured creditors or secured creditors may have claims for alter ego pre-petition, yet the bankruptcy trustee has standing because it's a general claim to bring that property into the estate, administer it for the benefit of the estate. The second one is the Third Circuit's opinion, Cybergenics, dealing with state law fraudulent conveyance claims. In that situation, it's clear that only creditors pre-petition have these rights to set aside a fraudulent conveyance, yet post-petition, the bankruptcy trustee has those rights. So there are two instances at least in bankruptcy law that this occurs where property is not property of the debtor pre-petition becomes available for the creditors post-petition. I think that's an important thing for this argument.
Now, your opponent argues that the anti-assignment cases on which you rely from Illinois really do not establish the general proposition that at least this language was sufficient to prevent OMC from giving this security interest from assigning rights in those assets.
Well, the restatement of contracts, which they rely on, and they also rely on a New York case that involved a piece of real estate, but I've not found really an Illinois case that basically in this context would apply or really have any purpose. Now, the Lomas case that they cite, that's their primary case, the Lomas case. That was a case on a motion to dismiss. Judge Norgel said that Judge Norgel never reached the issue of whether or not the contract itself was assigned. They basically said, we're going to distinguish between assigning the contract and the right to sue under the contract. The contract was no longer executory at that time, and the court said it would serve no useful purpose to enforce the anti-alienation provision in that contract. Also, the language was not anywhere near as clear as in 4.03, and there were no tax ramifications there as well. 4.03 basically says it is the intent of the parties here too that the trust corpus is and shall remain at all times subject to claims of general creditors of the company. And general creditors, it's clear, I think, in Judge Mannion's opinion, which we cited, general creditors means unsecured creditors in the grain merchants case that I'm talking about. And there's a legion of cases that go back. It is a term of art in bankruptcy. General creditors are meant to be unsecured creditors. So there's no question that this language reflected the party's intent that not to create a security interest. And why? Because they wanted to protect the executives. They didn't want to have a default on a credit agreement and let the bank take the money or any other unsecured creditor.
It does seem to me that the logic of what has been decided so far by the lower court, if one were to accept it, is that once this money gets paid into the estate and then the distribution of the monies in the estate is considered by the bankruptcy judge, they're having decided that there is no security interest that was ever created in these rabbi trust funds, Bank of America will not be entitled to claim any kind of priority in distribution.
That's correct. They will share as an unsecured creditor. And I think the issue that Judge Barlean reserved was really this term of general creditors. Can the money be used to pay administrative expenses of the Chapter 7 estate? Because the Chapter 7 estate creditors are not, they're not really creditors of OMC. And we'll have to deal with that issue when the case gets back downstairs. But I think that was the issue he was reserving. Clearly, the Chapter 11 administrative expenses are claims against OMC. OMC was the debtor in possession at that time until conversion. After conversion, though, there's an issue of whether or not Chapter 7 expenses, I think, can be paid because they're no longer general creditors of OMC. They're general creditors of the bankruptcy estate or perhaps the trustee, qua trustee, but not of OMC, and I think that's the issue that was
reserved. That's the reserved issue.
When you say they're not general credit, you mean people who have incurred administrative expenses and have a claim, you say they have a claim against the bankruptcy estate rather than against
OMC. Now, maybe that's somewhat of a distinction with, or a difference without a distinction. I don't know about that, but I think that was the issue that Judge Barley wanted to determine as to how the money ultimately gets distributed. Is it only Chapter 11 expenses and pre-petition creditors? Is it Chapter 7 administrative expenses? I think that was what the confusion was.
I go back to it for a second. I understand your point about how if a lien could be created in this fund, then the executives could be hurt because the creditor could foreclose on a lien even though there was no bankruptcy. That I understand. But you tied that somehow, or you introduced it by saying this was to protect executives in the event of a buyout. I don't understand.
Oh, no. Maybe I misspoke. I'm sorry. The original Rabbi Trust, I think, was set up to protect the executives to make sure they had a fund of money in the event that there was a change of control. That the new owners would come in and basically treat them differently than they thought they should be treated. So they negotiated.
Oh, I see. So that's,
That was the point that I was making.
Right.
And I think that if you gave the executives the lien on these funds, they would have too much of an equitable ownership interest in the funds to satisfy the IRS. And if you give a lien to another creditor, you jeopardize the executive's right to that money in the event there's no insolvency and there's a change of control. So that's why 4.03.
Well, you're creating incentive for the company to make a selective default, just default on the one loan. That'll get paid by the lien, and suddenly there's no funding in the rabbi trust.
That's correct. And then the secured creditor gets paid, the executives don't get paid, and oh well. And I think that was one of the reasons that those provisions are there. If your honors don't have any other questions, I'll...
Thank you. Mr. Gillow, how much time does he have? No time? Well, we'll give you a minute if you have something.
Your Honor, just a couple of very quick points. Sure. On Lomas, it was on a motion to dismiss basis, but the court did clearly state...
This is a district court case?
This is the district court case, yes, Your Honor.
Well, how much weight should we give to a district court case?
To the extent that it is one of the leading cases in the jurisdiction...
What do you mean, leading case?
Well, in the district court level, Your Honor.
But how much weight should a court of appeals give to a district court?
We believe the reasoning is valid, and that basis mm-hmm. should be given weight by this court, Your Honor. With respect to the pre- and post-petition issue and the issue of that has been raised by counsel for the trustee, there are very significant issues below as to whether or not this is property of the estate, and certain consequences flow that relate to pre- and post-petition financing that was provided by Bank of America on a pre-petition basis and by DIP financers afterwards.
Well, I don't understand. If it says that this money has to be available to satisfy claims of the company's general creditors, doesn't that mean that this money is in the bankrupt estate?
We agree with that fully, Your Honor. But so there are just concerns as to what pots of money will this $13.5 million be allocated to, and that is one of the issues on which Judge Barley reserved, we believe, and not just with respect to credit Chapter 11 versus Chapter 7, but there's a whole quite an extensive issue. We had actually a separate argument on that before Judge Barley. He specifically reserved on that issue, and on that basis, this issue really has not been addressed in any measure or form by the district court.
What is the bearing of that on this appeal?
Well, just to the extent that that issue has not been briefed before this court
But how does it affect you?
It affects
Bank of America.
Bank of America, in the sense that Bank of America participated in both pre- and post-petition loans, and to the extent that certain... In our view, the trustee has to make certain showings with respect to money that was loaned post-petition to demonstrate that that money was not subject to a pre-petition.
Wait, I'm lost. So you have a post-petition claim. You made a post-petition loan. How does that relate to the rabbi trust?
It relates to the rabbi trust to the extent that a separate security interest was given with respect to all post-petition financing. And so one of the issues is how to protect the pre-petition lenders who allowed a post-petition security interest to be given on all property. And there are allocation issues that will have to be heard before the bankruptcy court.
Well, I'm completely lost.
And, Your Honor,
I thought the only issue for us is whether putting aside the tax policy, tax issue, whether this Section 403 prevented Outboard from creating a security interest in Bank of America.
It is, Your Honor. The only reason I raise it is to suggest that the issue has been not addressed either by the district court or briefed before this
Which
court.
Which issue hasn't it?
This issue of the pre- and post-petition.
Well, how does that relate to 403?
It doesn't, except to the extent that the trustee is seeking to have something addressed by this court with respect to the post- and pre- and post-petition aspects of this, of the rabbi trust.
Oh. All right, you just don't want us to.
I don't want you to address that issue because it hasn't been raised in brief before. Yes,
okay,
Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both parties.